All right, we're ready. Today's a fascinating share. Let's, first of all, today is, September 11th. Isn't that a date that we're not happy about? 9/11, 2017. And I have to say that Vic is a very happy person that he listened to the Rebbe. You owe me. Big. B-I-G. How far are you from Boynton Beach? I saw movies on the website. What went on there? How far were you away from Boynton?
15 minutes.
Wow. All right, Baruch Hashem. And to all my students in Florida, Hashem Yimachem. Although I understand the heart of the storm did not hit Miami Beach. It hit further south. Am I correct? That's what I understand from the New York Times.
But it was still...
No, I understand it.
It was powerful enough. There were at least three... These big building cranes came down.
Oh, and I know that the electricity is totally out all over a million homes, they say.
3 million.
Wow. Shem Yerachim, there's a friend of mine here who can't get back to Florida. I'll call him later, find out how he's doing. Okay, and coming back just very briefly, it seems, I don't know, I just touched upon points, Kaliyach Yad, but they made a big hit over the world. On yesterday's shir, someone should do an article for tradition on the sons of Rav and what he meant when he said, you can't use machine matzahs, Hatam Kamus Imadi. Very fascinating. And what we uncovered yesterday, the Sakmuruv, and how I tied it together with Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, and it's a tie-in, it's 100% logical. So we achieved almost the impossible of bringing the Sakmuruv and bringing him into the Rav's life. I also want to mention my dear student, Rav Yeshua Grinstein. So if you recall, I spoke about why Chassidim don't want to say Tachnun, the Vachadikait. So evidently in the Shir, I translated Vachadikait into weekdayness. And according to my Talmud, I have a copyright in that word. I just invented a new word, weekdayness. He also sends a link, and this is very interesting. I looked at it last night. I cried like a baby, but I've seen it before. There's a video, if you go to YouTube, there's a video, there are a number of videos of the Rav. These videos, without going into the whole story now, these videos were done late in the Rav's life. At that point, video began and why you got money, there was a certain grant, and there were a number of videos made of the Rav. It's very difficult for me to watch because I remember the Rav is when I had him as a Rebbe, and here you see him in old age, and you can see how it's affected his demeanor, his deportment. It's hard. Nevertheless, it's the Rav. And there in a tshuva drasha, he talks about how Chassidim don't want to leave Shabbos. And it's worth picking it up. It's not exactly what I quoted in class. What I quoted, you look into my work on the Rav, I quoted from an earlier period. But it's the same concept, and the audience is mesmerized. Anyone watching it, they're mesmerized by the Rav talking about the Chassidic shtibble. So I want to thank Rabbi Grinstein for cluing us in. Now, coming back here, what we did last week, and it's important to understand, there were Jews in America who cared, there were Yekis who cared, there were Chassidic Jews who cared, there were Spanish Portuguese Jews who cared, but what do you do, this tidal wave of assimilation? You want to be an American, you don't want to be a greenhorn, you don't want to be laughed at, the kids are running away from Yiddishkeit. And the OU was organized in 1898, and I showed you in great detail, and I believe I'm absolutely right. They had high hopes, JTS. JTS began as a bastion against Reform Judaism. And by 1898 already, you started to see the winds of change in JTS. It didn't happen as quickly as things happen today. Today, I've read some of the writings of some Chovevei Torah graduates. How old is Chovevei Torah? 20 years. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't even think it's 20 years old. It took JTS graduates 100 years to reach this level of rebellion against God and Torah and all that Torah stands for. Today it happens much quicker because there's the internet, we're in touch with one another, we correspond with one another, we encourage one another, these chat groups, and it's very important to utilize it for good, you understand. Until now you had one organization that if someone left Yiddishkeit, I think it's called Footsteps, Chassidim, running away from Satma, running away from Ger, running away from a narrow-minded existence, so they chat, they encourage, and I did it, you did it, 1,000 did it, 10,000 did it, and they're eating Chazer on Yom Kippur. So another group has been organized now in America, and here too in Israel. In America it's called Makom, that you can stop being a Satma Chassid, you can stop being a Belza Chassid, but it doesn't mean you throw the baby out with the bathwater. And the same thing has happened now in Israel. But 100 years ago, 120 years ago, it took time, but JTS is starting to change. And the OU was organized. But then we ended off this year, when all is said and done, this did not impact upon the East European immigrant. Because he looked, I gave you the life last week of Rabbi Drachman, Rabbi Mendes. They looked upon these people. It's like you introduce a kid, sometimes I'm embarrassed, they say to a young man, this is Harav Rakefet, he's a Talmud Chacham, and he's this and that. The poor kid is looking at me, he can't even start to identify, no white shirt, no black pants, no beard, no payas, no third person. You understand? All right, maybe one day he'll learn with me and see beneath the outer veneer. He'll understand that the Ramchal didn't have a beard either. Baruch Hashem, we have a nice role model, the Mesil Tisharim, the Ramchal. They couldn't feel that much at home, although they admired their Shmirat Mitzvah. There's no question about it that Pereira Mendes and Rav Yaakov Yosef got along with each other, admired each other, attempted to help Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Bernard Drachman was not yet a Sheng Dover. He becomes a prominent, by 1910, he is a Sheng Dover. Now, there's no question the organization of the OU in 1898 impacts upon the Rabbanim and plants the seeds of what's going to happen a few years later. I want to come back to the East Side, and then I want to show you something very fascinating. Coming back to the book I quoted at the end of last week's shiur, the volume that just came out, it's an interesting memoir. If you knew the Spiegel family and you know the East Side, you'll enjoy reading it. But the historic part is far from accurate. It's anecdotes. But as I said to you, as Mori Rebbe once asked the Rebbe this very question, Rebbe, all these stories that they tell about Gedolei Yisrael, are they correct? Are they true? And the Rebbe said, it's not important whether they're true or not. It shows you how the Jewish people related to Gedolei Yisrael. And these stories that we hear about, they're not going to write stories like that about me, the Rebbe said. You understand? These are stories, Gedolim versus Amol Geven, but not about me. So you see, we ended off last week with the story of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef locked in the freezer, and his Talmud gets him out, and his Talmud said, this is the first time there's been a kosher person inside this freezer. Believe me, that never happened. I told you it did happen with the Ritbaz, and it is true, that he took his family Saturday morning, got on the train, took off for New York, Pikuach Nefesh, to get out of Chicago. I just want to show you how far this feeling goes, and it reflects what was happening in New York. If you go to page 251, they tell another story. And it's impossible. It's absolutely never happened. I can tell you it's impossible because serious scholarship was done in RJJ. Abraham Kopp, Abraham Kopp, who I yet knew personally, was a seminary graduate. He graduated probably in the 30s from the seminary. He was a Shomer Shabbos 100% in his own personal life. His shul was conservadox, but he himself, and he did research. He was the first one to do research on Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. And in 1897, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef suffered a stroke. He had a lot of aggravation. He suffered a stroke. He was crippled to the end of his life. But here they tell a story how he suffered the stroke. And Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was walking down the streets of the East Side. A shadow of his former self, just a few years earlier, had been venerated as the Rebbe of thousands. And now all that was history. The chief rabbi of New York was a target of ridicule, with only a small group of loyal supporters who stayed with him. And it goes on, and it describes, he sees a butcher shop. And in the butcher shop, he sees certification with his name on it, and in the window, a large cut of pork in the display window. And they attribute the what happened to him physically to that sight, to that scene. All right, it's a nice anecdote. It could have never happened. As far as the Jews were from Yiddishkeit, to put pork in a kosher butcher shop on the east side of New York, if I can use the language I grew up in the yeshiva world, azay vaitnisht. That far, not. But it reflects the period. Then he goes on and he tells the story of the funeral. Now, if you recall, a number of years ago, I told you the story of the funeral. And here, again, the version here is different. Ho and Company, and that's the name. They came to, Rivington Street, whatever. They're on their way now, going across the bridge into Brooklyn. Remember, he's going to be buried much further into Brooklyn, what the cemetery we spoke about yesterday. And what is it called? Where he's buried, Cypress Hill, and across
Mount
the
Judah.
And Mount Judah is across the street, I believe.
Up the block.
Yeah, they're you've never been there. It's like I was there. It's amazing. It's right between Brooklyn and Queens, two major Jewish cemeteries, Jewish areas next to each other. On one side, the side closer to Brooklyn, is the chief rabbis buried there with all the famous names from that period. Everyone is buried around him. They paid a fortune. Each one bid to be buried near the chief rabbi. We spoke about it a few years ago. And across the road is the Brisker section where Gedolei Yisrael, that's slightly closer to Queens. So when they came to the corner from Ho and Company, the goyim there, Irish, Italians, they saw all these Jews, and according to what I know, it was a company that built screws, bolts, nuts, and they threw down at the Jews. And the Jews went into the building, started fighting with the Irish, the Italian, the police came and arrested the Jews. It was a tremendous riot at the funeral. Out of that, the police department of New York was cleaned up. The commissioner of police had to resign. They were accused of anti-Semitism. And it is true, they say, until today, there's never really been major anti-Semitism in the New York City Police Department. So much so that, like the Israeli police, they have Haredim today working for the police department in Israel, too. This is they not only have Haredim policemen, they have women, Harediyot, who work in the investigation department of the police, because lo aleinu, when you have crimes in the Haredi world, a girl who has been, misused, whatever word you want to use, she can't talk to a man about it, but she can talk to a woman. They have Haredi up now. So they say in the New York Police Department that they cleared up the anti-Semitism as a result of the funeral. Now here you read about that it was a large publishing house. Lo Hayav, Lo Nivra, as far as I know, all the research shows it was nuts, bolts, screws, metal. That's what they rang down. He calls it here a pogrom, but you can imagine how the Jews felt. This is 1902. How the Jews felt. Here was a man who was so great, such a Talmud Chacham, comes to America, and look what finally happens. Even his funeral is a major disgrace, a major item of news. East Side, anti-Semitism, Jews who couldn't care less about him during his lifetime, acharei mot kedoshim. And I can tell you that when Reb Aaron Cutler died in 62, I don't know how many of you remember this, Reb Aaron died, so there was a tremendous funeral on the East Side. And do you remember the funeral? Hundreds of, tens and tens of thousands. And I remember some of the old timers said, we haven't had a funeral like this in America. 60 years ago, Reb Yaakov Yosef, they spoke about the funeral was like the funeral of Reb Aaron Cutler. So the basic anecdotes may be incorrect, but the spirit they convey, absolutely correct. Now, before we go further, I want to show you something very, very fascinating. I'll introduce you to two different people. One who we spoke about, that'll be the second one I'll do very briefly, and one who we're going to meet for the first time. Look, these rabbis came to America, and as I said last week, and we'll come back to it later today, and I have something to give you that you may very well appreciate. All over America, great rabbanim came. Why did they come? Sometimes Balabatim called for them. Balabatim wanted a rav. They knew from the Alter Heim, from their shtut, some young man had grown up. It's a top Talmud Chacham. We want him with us in America. Other people, wanderlust. Not only, look, we all came in Aliyah, everyone sitting in this room. In order to come in Aliyah, there has to be a little bit wanderlust in us, the challenge. All right, in my case, it's all my wife, I have to be honest. She was the Six-Day War, but you talk about, all right, people will give you many reasons for coming in Aliyah, and they're all valid reasons, but there has to be a shtickle wanderlust. So there are people who, the challenge, the youth, I'm in my 20s, what am I going to do in Europe? Let me go to America, I have cousins. Rabbi Revel is a prime example. He got out of jail. He was arrested by the Tsarist government in 1905. They were agitating against the Tsar. Gets out of jail, and he said, what am I going to do in Europe? I have cousins in America. Let me go to America. It's a free country. They don't put people into jail for political points of view. And that feeling is there. There were others who ran away from Europe, whatever the reasons were. They were bankrupt in Europe. They owed money. They come to America. They start all over. Reb Lazer Silva, you all know the story. Reb Lazer Silva married on his own. He met the girl in the Strassum Library, Basia, a beautiful young lady, and he fell in love with her, Baruch Hashem, and everyone gossiped. How could his father was a shtut rav? How could the rav's son marry without a shidduch? He said, the heck with you people. He went to America. No one's going to bother him for marrying on his own. All right, everyone has their own story, and they were all over America. But now the question comes up, what do you do with your children? And we are, a rav, your children, the Rebbetzin, the future, where do you educate? So very fascinating, and people have not written about this. It's interesting. I throw out ideas, I've done my share in scholarship. Others can pick up. Research has to be done on the second generation of the original Rabbanim who came to America. What did they do with their kids? Where did they send their kids? Now, there's no yeshiva in America yet. Yes, you have yeshivas from Yitzchok Chanan, but it's not organized. Remember, I've spoken, again, I don't want to repeat my lectures of years ago. The yeshiva does not reorganize as a real yeshiva with a curriculum, with smicha, with learning, till Rabbi Revel comes to the yeshiva in 1915, 1916, 1919. They have their first graduation, five men, if I remember correctly, looking to revel, five men get smicha, and these are five men who learned for smicha on the east side of New York, and yeshivas was chachana. Now there's a real yeshiva. One of the five was an American-born youngster. Okay, that was Rabbi Salbi Friedman. Maybe some of you remember him, young Israel of Washington Heights, a lawyer born in Pittsburgh. Oh, did that make news? An American-born youngster getting smicha with four other fellas who came from Europe. But 1900, you didn't have a yeshiva, you didn't have an organization. So what they did, they sent their children back to Europe. The tata, you know, you got to remember, these kids spoke perfect English. Obviously, it's like our, like my children growing up here, all my children are bilingual, Hebrew and English. With the grandchildren, I have some who are totally bilingual and some who are less. But you all understand, it's a gradual process. These people grew up with Hebrew, with Yiddish and with English. So to go back to Europe, learning in a Litvish yeshiva was not that difficult for them. So let's try to understand what's happening with these kids, what's happening with these young men, what's happening, what do they do, the profession. And here you see once again, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, you see the tensions. How do you keep Yiddishkeit and the American influence? Now, this is a very fascinating picture. Anyone know who this is? You've all heard of Ramaz, Reb Moshe Zvulun Margolis. This is his son, Sam Margolis. Okay, look at the picture. Think of the father, what the father looked like. The father, long beard, a European Rav. This is his brilliant son who grew up in America. Look at the eyes, look at the stare. Brilliant individual. The father sent him back to Europe to tell yeshiva. He has to know how to learn. He has to be a Talmud Chacham. He came back to America and he went to Harvard. So here you have an individual who Talmud Chacham, Tells graduate, Harvard graduate, totally at home in English and in Yiddish. And he is the first Orthodox rabbi, takes a shteller in Cleveland, the first Orthodox rabbi in Cleveland who can preach in English. Okay, you understand? Shifting gears, all right? Someone, an immigrant, conquered America, went back to Europe, can preach in English, Orthodox rabbi, and he has a shteller in Cleveland. But here you see the American influence. Shomer Shabbos. However, I'm quoting, let me just tell you what I'm quoting from. This is an article that appeared in the American Jewish Archives. It's a Jewish monkey trial, the Cleveland Jewish Center, and the emerging borderline between Orthodox and conservative Judaism in 1920s North America. It's by Ira Robinson. And I thank Professor Engelberg, Abba Engelberg, who heads up Machon Tal, Rabbi Dr. Abba Engelberg. I believe he's a full colonel as well. Am I right, Yitzchak? Did you know him? I think he reached the rank of full colonel in the chaplaincy in the American Army. If I'm wrong, I stand to be corrected, but I believe I'm right. And I'll explain to you what the monkey trial, what that's all about afterwards, because that comes later. It involved his grandfather. So he had this article. I said, I want to see it because it has information that's very, we'll come back to the monkey trial. You'll see it plays a role, but we're ahead of our times now. But coming back to Sam Margolis, here he is in Cleveland, introduces confirmation. Now, confirmation, this was something the Jews got from the Gentiles. Confirmation ceremony, we wound up doing confirmation, Shavuos time. Are you familiar in all the temples? What is confirmation? A joint ceremony for all the children. It's not in place of a bar mitzvah ceremony, but it's in addition to a bar mitzvah ceremony. But a confirmation service is something already, the very word, the very topic, the symbol address, the confirmation, the Pledge of Allegiance, is sishmeknish azay yiddish. Okay, how do you translate? It doesn't smell so good. By the way, I want to tell you in parentheses that in Israel, this version has come up many times, and here it comes up in a very positive fashion. Anyone reading my mind? You notice I said it doesn't take the place of a mitzvah service. But we have a regular, a very real question. What about women who reach the age of bat mitzvah? What do you do for the girls? And we're living at a time where we can't say to a girl, oh, it's unimportant, bat mitzvah, my grandmother didn't have a bat mitzvah. You'll lack nothing if you don't have a bat mitzvah. So some people do a regular bat mitzvah with a ceremony, with a suda. In many of the religious high schools, what they do is literally a confirmation service. The year that the girls all reach 12, they do some focal ceremony together. And that way you achieve, on one hand, the bat mitzvah. On the other hand, you don't turn it into a bar mitzvah. You're not turning the girl into a boy. There's a lot to be said for it. I believe in Chorev, if I recall correctly, with my daughters, each time there was a bat mitzvah, we'd be 5, 6 girls together. It wouldn't be individual little affairs. So to a certain degree, that's an emulation of a confirmation service on a positive level. Yes, Morty?
Wasn't it in previous generations in from places they would have a bat mitzvah, but it would be in the house as a private ceremony? Well, not a ceremony, it would be a private celebration. It wasn't totally new.
In the what you're saying was, the truth of the matter is, what was a bat mitzvah in the old country? 100 years ago, 200 years ago, bar mitzvah meant the kid got an aliyah and they drank the lechayim and had a shtickle herring. That was Reb Aaron Soloveitchik's bar mitzvah. You understand? His father was in America. But today, it's a bar mitzvah becomes a major affair, and a girl. So of course you tell a girl, don't be upset. The wedding is your affair. So my wife says, yeah, but the men. So I told Malka, but you notice, whenever there's a machlokes over something at the wedding, I will always say, you listen to the husband, the man to be, you listen to the wife. I would tell the husband to be, you had a bar mitzvah, the wedding is for her. All right. And I think this is the proper attitude that we Jewish Torah people have to have. But all right, a confirmation is an innovation. It's before Shavuot.
Right, it's a copy of the Lutheran church.
It's a copy of the Protestant church, basically. I don't know if only Lutherans, but the Protestants are very big on public confirmations. So you see, here is Sam Margolius, a graduate of Tells, a son of Ramaz, a Talmud Chacham, a Harvard graduate, and the precious of America. But this is minor. You see, a confirmation, you can turn around, you can use it constructively. Ah, but now let me go one step further. What he also had was a late Friday night service. And this is something we have long forgotten. 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, right now in South Africa, and right now in Australia, to a certain degree, this problem haunts us until today. What is a late Friday night service? Jews are traditional. What does tradition mean? Do you read the Israeli papers? I, on principle, do not read the Jerusalem Post, because I don't think the Post brings you into the real mainstream of Israel. But I happen to look at every week, at the weekend, I see Maariv, I see Yediot, I see Makor Rishon. Sometimes I even give a peek at Haaretz. I want to know what's going on here. So you read Yediot every week, they interview some well-known personality. What do you do Friday night? That's the question. Yom Shishi. And you'll see 80% of the time, Machalalei Shabbos, Alchlin Avelis, and Treifis, no concept of sexual morality. They Kiddush. Jump over to their mother, they travel here, go there, Kiddush, Kiddush, Kiddush. You see, it's a certain connection. It's good. I'm not being critical. Sarah Netanyahu used to drive her children Friday night to her father's house in Katamon to hear her father make Kiddush. All right. It's good. It's not enough. It's not proper. But at least it's a starting point. The late Friday night services during the winter. Everyone works Friday. How can you get home 4 o'clock? Yeah, I can come. I want to go to temple. I want to go to synagogue. I want to feel Jewish. But I can only come at 7 o'clock. So the Reform, then the Conservative, and here you see even the Orthodox. And this becomes a point, a bone of contention, the late Friday night service. Very fascinating. So you had shuls. Shabbos begins 4 o'clock. Regular davening. Who is at the davening? Retirees, 70 years and older, and a few young kids and teenagers. Then, 7 o'clock, 7:30, a whole new service with a sermon. Places filled. People in the prime of life. Is this Yiddishkeit? A compromise. Clash. Why did I mention South Africa? Why did I mention Australia, essentially Sydney? Everyone goes to shul Friday night there. Shul's a mob, men, women, overwhelming. Many are Machalos Shabbos, lo aleinu. South Africa, you should know, has the highest percentage of Shmirat Shabbat of any Jewish country in the world, maybe even more than the state of Israel. Highest percentage. The amount of Chozrim B'Tshuva is overwhelming. The Chevra Kadisha in Johannesburg has a rule. You can't be a member of the Chevra Kadisha unless you've been a Shomer Shabbos for 10 years. Or, you follow what that says? Tells you something. You know why there's so many Balei Tshuva there? Let it be said to the credit of South Africa, the rabbinate does not have machleket within it. It has chabadnikim, it has what they call yeshiva college, which is to a certain degree an emulation of yeshiva university. It has all the balei tshuva yeshiva there, or sameach, what are the other, eish haTorah. You have Israelis, Sfadim there, no machloket, one heksha, and they have a tremendous amount of balei tshuva. It's to the credit of the rabbinate there. But you have Machalalei Shabbos. So I'm in Sydney, Australia. I'm in the shul, Chabad rabbi, but a Chabad rabbi, totally integrated, totally sophisticated. I don't think he ever graduated high school, but he knew the Britannica by heart, backwards and forwards. I couldn't believe the man's breadth of knowledge. And in his shul, Yutaka begin Mincha at the right time. After Mincha, there's an entire class that the rabbi teaches. After the class that the rabbi teaches, they begin with a chazen, L'chuna Ranana, with all the singing. And after Mizmor Shir and Bamen Madlikin, 2 hours after you began, the place is filled to capacity. Then the guest scholar from Jerusalem speaks. Yitzchak, you with me? By that time, it's a late Friday night service. That's the way the rabbi solved the problem. No break, you understand? Not like America, where there's a regular service, and 3 hours later, they reconvened for the Mechalalei Shabbos. No, they didn't light Shabbos candles on Shabbos. That's reform. That's not beyond reform, Lo Aleinu. Look, God have mercy. I saw that with my own eyes. As you know, it still hurts my eyes until today. Not only that, interesting. In that shul, it's a breakaway. 3 blocks away, another Chabad shul opens. Chabad, Australia is all Chabad. It doesn't mean it's not Chabad. It's Chabad low-key, what I call Chabad light, okay? I hope I'm not creating a new word now, but Chabad light. So I said to them, nice people, good people. There was a medical doctor there, the most respected person by guy by Jews. It's Shmuley Boteach's father-in-law. He married into a good family. So I asked around, why did you organize a new shul? You have a Chabad, a big shul, beautiful shul. By the way, a very interesting shul where you walk in, the women walk down and the men walk up. It's in the middle you walk in, and it's not the women walking up, the men walk up. I don't know, it's a configuration by an architect that no woman can feel second best. It's literally the men, women, totally equal. So I said, why are you organizing a new shul? So they said to me, Rabbi, I like to eat my Shabbos meal at the proper time. I have to starve myself because of the Mechalalei Shabbos? In this shul, it's the Chunaranana, Barchu, home for Kiddush. Okay, can't argue with that. But you see right away, look, Sam Margolis, the Ramaz's son. This is the rabbinate. This is America. This is what's happening. Now, unfortunately, the story with Sam Margolis ends in 1917. He's killed in an automobile accident. But just to fill you in, and we'll come back to this much later in this year, just to fill you in, Cleveland is expanding. Vibrant Jewish community. Shuls are merging. Shuls are coming out of downtown Newark where they began. People are now moving to what was called the suburbs, the fancier areas. And you have one tremendous shul, a seminary graduate comes out to Cleveland. Let me give you his name, Rabbi Benjamin. I taught descendants of these people. Samuel Benjamin, graduate of the seminary, 1918, comes out to Cleveland. Wonderful rabbi. Shomer Shabbos, preaching in English. Can speak Yiddish. No problem with a confirmation service. If it's not a problem for Sam Margolis, it's not a problem for him. No problem with a late Friday night service. But then the shul begins to shake. Nothing has changed. 100 years later, we're shaking with the same problem. Why a mechitza? Why are women treated as their second-class citizens? Why do they have to sit behind the curtain? Women who are going to college, women who are going to university already, women who are smoking in public, remember, it's not Virginia Slims. Women who have the vote. It's amazing. In America, the suffragettes win. This is 100 years ago. In Switzerland, the women didn't get the vote until the 1970s, if I'm correct, in some of the cantons there. Why the mechitza? And believe it or not, they get rid of Rabbi Sam Benjamin. He's too frum for the congregation. And there's another JTS graduate, Solomon Goldman. Don't forget that name. If you very important JTS graduate, he comes to Cleveland, and he already is willing to give a toshav, give the toshav what he wants. And in this congregation, a tremendous legal battle broke out. Orthodox shul, for so many tens and tens of years, how can you take away the mechitza? How can you give in to the masses? How can you break with tradition? And this went a lower court, an appeals court, the Supreme Court, everything in Ohio was lower court decision, take the mechitza down, the appeals court can't take the mechitza down, the ultimate court, take the mechitza down, and you can't win in a situation like this, because the balabatim, either you take the mechitza down or we're walking out and organizing a new synagogue. Cleveland shook. This is where Abba Engelberg, do you know Rabbi Engelberg? And I'm talking about Dr. Engelberg. His grandfather, the name was Katz, was the leading balabas who fought for the mechitza. And he called in Rabbanim from the Agudas Rabbanim. There was testimony, you'll see, Reb Lazer Silva. Many questions were asked. This battle became classic. It paved the way for what would happen later in Mount Clemens and repeated itself all the way down to modern times, Utopia Parkway Jewish Center, which we'll talk about Sunday perhaps. But, wow. Solomon Goldman saw the machloket, and he said, why do I have to stay in Cleveland? In Chicago, there was a big conservative temple that grew out of many Orthodox little synagogues where they pleaded with him, we need you in Chicago. And he goes on to become the very famous Rabbi Solomon Goldman in Chicago. But here's a classic study. A son of Ramaz, what happened? Where was he? Growing up, tells, but already innovation. Confirmation, late Friday night services, these were the major issues at that time. One more rabbi I want to mention very briefly. We spoke about him in depth last year. Very fascinating personality. A lot has been written about him. You remember the name? Yitzchak, I made a copy for you of this article. It's very fascinating. Rabbi Harry Epstein. Rabbi Harry Epstein. This is a little later. Rabbi Sam Margolis is mamish at the turn of the century. Rabbi Harry Epstein is born at the turn of the century, 1903-2003. 100 years of life. Rabbi Harriet Epstein, who was his father? Again, Chicago. His father was Rabbi Ephraim Epstein, the dean of the Orthodox rabbinate in Chicago. Who was Rabbi Ephraim Epstein? Younger brother of Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Levush Mordechai, the Slabotka Chevron Rosh Yeshiva. Who are we talking about? To mention his name, we should be standing, not sitting. And this is Reb Ephraim Epstein's son, Harry. And where did Harry study? In Chicago? And then his father sent him to Chevron to study with his uncle in Chevron. Do you understand what we're talking about? An Adam Gadol, a Talmud Chacham, first rate. married a Rav's daughter, a from lady 100%. Comes back to America, college degrees, brilliant individual, speaks Yiddish, speaks English. Mark Bauman, B-A-U-M-A-N, did the research on his life. I'm quoting from the American Jewish Archives now. He also published this research that I'm quoting from, expands into basically a full book about Rabbi Harry Epstein. And I can tell you, here's his picture also. Handsome, good looking, clean shaven, Americanized, son of the rabbi, Rabbi Ephraim Epstein. I was the guest of the Atlanta community. So I wanted to see not just the Orthodox shuls, the shul where he was rabbi in Atlanta, the big conservative temple. Went to see it. It's a square block. You can't believe how big it is, how big the grounds are, the buildings. And they gave me a tour of the temple, and there's a room like a sanctuary. No one enters it. Rabbi Henry Epstein's office, where he was rabbi. Harry Epstein, I should say. Where he was rabbi. The books, everything is there. Circa 2000, 1990, 1980, nothing budged, nothing changed. It's like he's still in his office. They revere him until today. Comes back to America in 19, his uncle, the Levush Mordechai, visited America, as I know, twice. To raise funds for Chevron, for Slabatka. His nephew, Harry, accompanied him, went with him all over America. The Levush Mordechai spoke in Yiddish. Harry translated into English. He becomes Rav in Tulsa, Oklahoma first. That's the city that the congregation that the Revel family built, Travis, Revel's in-laws, Oil, Tulsa. Rabbi Solomon Kahn was Rav there many years later. Anyone, the politician in New York is married to his daughter. There's a son living in Efrat or the Gush, Kahn, David Kahn, if I'm not mistaken, my student. And his sister studied at New York Mahon Gold. And she married, give me the names of the politicians, the well-known one, what's his name, from Borough, from Borough Park, from Brooklyn. Dov Hyken is married to Rabbi Kahn's daughter, thank you. And they're from Tulsa. From Tulsa, shul is not big enough. It never was a gigantic shul. It was a shul in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Jews in the oil industry, those who were Shema Mitzvah. From there he goes to Atlanta, Ahavat Achim, 1928. He never leaves. He builds the shul, conducts Talmud classes in Yiddish for the remaining traditionalists. An outstanding speaker in English, young and handsome. He could keep the allegiance of the acculturating middle-aged group and attract their children to the synagogue. At first, on Yom HaNarayim, he spoke in English and Yiddish and gradually phased out the Yiddish, and everything was in English. And here you have the opposite of what we just spoke about. Friday night during the summer, early services. Oh. Morty's all excited, the Makabel Shabbos with the plag, beautiful. Nothing to do with the plag. Friday night during the summer, movies were shown all over Atlanta, Georgia. All the kids wanted to go to the movies. The regular Friday night service already was 7 o'clock. The movies were 7:30, 5 o'clock, Rabbi Epstein opened the synagogue and had a Kabbalah Shabbos. The older members staged the lockout. But the rabbi went out and said, at least they'll attend services, even if they'll go to the movies afterwards. Let's go a step further. You see what's happening? And this is a Talmud of the Levush Mordechai. We're not talking about a JTS fellow who learned on 122nd and Broadway. It's a Talmud Chacham, sein Tata, sein Vetter, his uncle.
JTS graduates, they even show movies on
Friday night. Today, we're not talking about, forget about JTS today. Today, there's no Shabbos, there's no Kashrut, there's nothing, there's no Tarat Mishpacha, and Lo Aleinu, I was embarrassed upstairs here. There's a wonderful lady who works, the controller of Gruss. Her name is, last name is Pinchas. She married the son of, we spoke about it yesterday, didn't we? Married the son of Rav Shimon Pinchas, and she says to me, even in the Mamlachti Dati world already, take a look what's going on with the lesbianism, Lo Aleinu, with Bennett. I told her I'm a man without a party. The first time in 49 years living in Israel, I don't know who I'm going to vote for in the next election. Vote, I will vote. You cannot say life is not perfect. The worst chinuch is to not vote and say, no, we got a Mashiach is not here yet. I'm not a messianist. But you have to vote. But I have to wait and see what's going to be. But forget about that now. Let's come back here.
This Rabbi Epstein, Harry,
Which Rabbi Epstein talk about? Harry? He's a Talmud of Slabodka, of Chevron. I told you, he went back to study with his uncle, with the Levush Mordechai. Then, of course, the problem that one says nothing has changed. And I told you this, I'll tell it to you again. It's an inside story, but it's worth repeating. Rabbi Joe Lookstein, Kilat Jeshurun today is overflowing on Shabbos. Hundreds and hundreds of worshippers there. George Rohr began a minyan for beginners. I mean, you can't believe what's going on in KJ. Wasn't always like that. In the 40s, after World War II, the West Side, alive with Yiddishkeit. Reb Aaron Kotler lived on the West Side. Reb Machtem Mendel Zaks, the Rosh, the Chofetz Chaim's son-in-law lived on the West Side. The brother of the Rebbe began on the West Side. There was Shtiblich on the West Side. There was a mikvah on the West Side. The East Side, Garnish McGarnish, beautiful building, KJ, history, Ramaz, no kosher place. Let's be honest, 1940s. So Rabbi Joseph Lookstein came up with the idea, maybe it's a problem. The women walking up two, three flights, if you're ever in KJ, it's like the old Judapayish shul. Bring the women downstairs. So there was a meeting of the board of directors. I know this from people who are at the meeting. It's an unbelievable sign. I want to put into context here. Rabbi Lookstein says, you know what, we'll bring the women down, everyone gets excited, the women will come. The next day, the president of the shul, Max Etra, says to Rabbi Lookstein, Rabbi, I want you to know that if you bring the women downstairs, I'll be leaving the shul. Says, well, I went home and I told my mother what you want to do, and my mother told me, that's not a shul, she cannot daven there, I can't go along with it.
With
a mechitza. With a mechitza, of course. In Atlanta, it's exactly the way it began. The women after World War II, we don't want to walk upstairs. Why can't we be downstairs? He brought them downstairs with a machitza. And gradually, the boundaries between the sexes eventually disappeared. And you can trace the whole story of Rabbi Epstein after World War II, when conservative Judaism was conquering the world. When Orthodox synagogues were shaking, where all over the United States there was machloket, mechitza, conservadox, what do we do? What can we compromise? What can't we compromise? In 1944, against his father-in-law's strong objections, against his father's strong objections, against his wife's strong objections, Harry Epstein led his shul officially into the conservative movement. And this goes on and on. What he could accept, 84, he's 84, 80 years old, Rabbi Emeritus, a new graduate comes in, Arnold Goodman, president of the Rabbinical Assembly of the Conservative Rabbinate? Oh boy, he already is not just no mechitza, women get a liot, women are part and parcel, integrated into the service, the precursor of women reading from the Torah, leading the service. And here's the saddest words that Bauman concludes. Ultimately, Rabbi Epstein regretted that he had agreed to compromises and agreed to become part of the conservative movement. Ultimately, he saw that what he started went way beyond anything that he could tolerate. And he died with regrets that he had enabled so much compromise for what once was an Orthodox synagogue. Gentlemen, lady, two case studies. Your father gave me an argument. I didn't acknowledge your mother, so that's why I said lady now. Two case studies, two Orthodox rabbis, two sons of East European Rebbeim, two graduates of East European Yeshivat, Rabbi Margolis, Rabbi Epstein. Look where they're coming from. And they were from, and they meant well. Don't misunderstand me. This is not a Solomon Goldman. Solomon Goldman was leading a rebellion. This is not a Solomon Goldman. But the hurricane of America, the waters, the waves, the friction, they couldn't keep the status quo. And once you give in, compromise begs compromise instead. Compromise creates compromise. Once you give in, just a little opening. Within a decade or so, it's a major fission. Two case studies. Very fascinating. And I want to go one case study further before I begin the organization of the rabbinate. Very fascinating. So you might think, all these rabbis came into America. Who were they? What were they? What's amazing is, among them were probably the greatest gedolim in the entire world. Giants of Torah. And yet, people that we know so little about, to use Torah language, verschwunden geworden, totally lost, totally swept away in the United States. And I want to use one name that I've mentioned many times and share with you the little information I have about him. I plead with someone sitting in front of me or listening across the world, try to do a doctorate on this man. See what can be uncovered. See what research you can come up with. I mention his name with awe, trepidation, my teeth chatting. Reb Yehuda Leib Foyer, F-O-R-E-R. His years, 1878-1948. You'll see why I have a very special connection to him. But you're talking about an individual who from youth on was an unbelievable Ilui. He studied in Volozhin. After studying, getting started in a new yeshiva that was just being organized in Telz. From Volozhin he went on to Brisk, where he studied with Reb Chaim. Now you all know in Brisk there was no formal yeshiva. People constantly think yeshiva Volozhin, yeshiva Telz. Brisk there was no formal yeshiva. Reb Chaim sat in the cloys, like a little base medrash, and he was learning. And anyone who wanted could come and join Reb Chaim in learning and developing ideas and thinking aloud and interacting with him. And obviously, if you wanted to interact with Reb Chaim, you had to be top quality. The shayas that pertained to the city, to Kashrut, so you all know that was Reb Chaim's arrangement with the city, that they would hire a dayan, and they hired Reb Simcha Zelig Rieger, who remained in Brisk, killed by Hitler in his 80s. Reb Simcha Zelig Rieger, a Volozhin graduate, but a Volozhin graduate before Reb Chaim revolutionized Torah study in Lithuania. Reb Simcha Zelig Rieger, a posek, absolute posek muvhak, Dalit Shulchan Aruch at his fingertips, Halacha l'maisa. So Reb Chaim, his task was to be Reb Chaim Briska, and the brightest minds came to him from all over Eastern Europe. The two greatest Talmidim he ever taught, they were Chavruta, was the Meitzher Te'ilui, Reb Shlomo Palachek, and Reb Yehuda Leib Foyer. And there's no question that one brought the other one to America. And there we come back to the history of what's called Yeshiva University today. How many of you were at the ceremony at Yeshurun yesterday? Anyone there? They had a direct hook in to see what was going on in America with the installation of our dear Talmud, Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman as the fifth president of Yeshiva University. So, you talk about Yeshiva University, again, I don't want to repeat myself, but we did this many, many years ago. Rabbi Rebel was very upset that all the Europeish Rabbanim who would come to America and come to raise funds in the Rosh Yeshiva, they would view Yeshiva Kibbutz Kol Hanan in the 1910s as a secondary institution. He wanted to make it the equal of any yeshiva in Europe. And Dov, in order to make a yeshiva great, you need a Rosh Yeshiva. You need someone who knows how to teach and has knowledge and is unique and innovative. Okay, you all know that. That's the blessing and the curse of the Litvish world. Because when it's a family institution, you see Telz today. Telz in Cleveland, there's no one there. They don't have Rosh Yeshiva. It has to be a family institution. Telz in Chicago, Telz in Riverdale, outsiders took over. The places are very successful. They deliver what the students want. All right, Yeshiva University is blessed because it's a public institution. And the faculty is not just family, it's ability to teach, etc. All right. Rabbi Revel is looking, he tried to get, I tell you, it's fascinating who he looked for. He looked for Reb Cheskel Lifshitz, the Kalish Rav, the Medrash Vamasa. He was very open, very broad, tremendous knowledge, but very matan. He would have been a perfect match for America. But the Kalish Rav wanted to go back to Poland. He was appreciative of Rabbi Revel's offer. He went back. Then Rabbi Revel landed on the Mechita, Why Reb Shlomo Palachek? Why was he willing to come to America? Because the Meitshita had been the Rosh Yeshiva in Lida. He was Rav Reines' Rosh Yeshiva in the first yeshiva that was dedicated to Torah Mada, Torah Vedas it was called. It was imagine a yeshiva that was a Zionist yeshiva with secular studies. You got a gymnasium degree. So the Meitshita came to America September 1st, 1922. He came to America 2 years later. Reb Yehuda Leib Feuer followed him to America. And Reb Yehuda Leib wound up in Holyoke. That was the shul he went to. That was the city. That's where he had Balabatim, who still knew about him from Europe, from his shtetl, and knew what a genius he was. They brought him to Holyoke, and he never left Holyoke. He remained there for the rest of his life. Now, here you have a man, the story is very sad at the end, at the age in 1928, he has a stroke, he's in his 50s, it's not a stroke, I should say, he has an infection in his gum, there's no antibiotics yet, osteomyelitis of the gum it was called, today we treat it with antibiotics, it cures itself within days. In those days, it went to his brain, his head, and that was the end. So the Meitshita only had a few years in America, 6 years, but quite an impact. Wonderful children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. I was Sandig at a Brit once, a son of a Talmud of mine, and running around in that room were endless little Shloimelers, great-great-grandchildren of the Meitshita. He was zeichet to have endless, and most of them live in Israel. It's just unbelievable what he was zeichet to. Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. Rabbi Yehuda Leib remained in Holyoke. So, all right, he's in Holyoke with all this learning. Somehow he has to come out of his shell. New York is now the center. So I have to tell you, Rabbi Rebel knew exactly who he was, invited him to the yeshiva, wanted him to get involved. Yeshiva's Chol Hanan couldn't remain in yeshiva's Reb Yitzchak Chol Hanan. Why? So I cite to you from the first edition of Avadim that I think is important, but I may be prejudiced. Bernard Rebel, builder of American Jewish Orthodoxy. First edition. Aaron Rothkopf, JPS. Okay, go to page 139 and you'll understand. I have a chapter there, Orthodox Opposition to the Yeshiva. It's amazing, I was a kid when I wrote this, but I have to say, Nishkasha. Do you follow me? Anyone who knows Yiddish understand? Not bad, not bad. What I wrote, nothing to be corrected. Orthodox opposition. In October 1932, a statement declaring that the yeshiva was a nest of atheism was distributed in Orthodox congregations throughout the Eastern Seaboard. Rabbi Judah Feuer of Holyoke, Massachusetts, sent Rebel a copy of a placard which read, "We Jews of New York discovered it, and that in the yeshivas, Reb Yitzchak Chanan, there is a nest of atheism up because us. Therefore, we do warn and announce that you should not send your children or the children of your acquaintances into this yeshiva until you find out what is going on in the yeshiva. Who is responsible for this terrible situation? And how is it to be remedied?" Rabbi Feuer also informed Rebel that he had validated its accusations. For, quote, "he showed the statement to a layman from New York whom I know to be honest and trustworthy and who possesses fear of God. And he told me that the placard is true. It may be that this isn't actually happening in the yeshiva proper, but in the Teachers Institute, the instructors teach biblical criticism with all the atheism that is inherent in this study."
Did Feuer join this, or he just informed?
For your, what was your last word? Yeah, or?
Or he just reported.
No, no, he, you'll see. He reported this to Revel. He wanted an answer. My dear students.
Did he join?
Join what? The yeshiva?
Yeshiva College.
No, I'll explain. It's exactly the point I want to make in me a second. Baruch atah melech olam she'akom yeretz yisrael. Here's the chavrit of the Meitshita. His best friend taught in the yeshiva. And here he's sending Revel a letter. I have the letter, and he's the placard, the accusation. And of course, what you're dealing with here is a very delicate problem that I've lectured on many times in the Kollel and many times outside of the Kollel. I actually lectured on it this summer in Plainview, Long Island. That's what they wanted to hear about. How do you run a college? A high school you can control. A college, the choice facing you, Vic, is either to be like a Catholic college or a liberal arts college where everything is open, there's no censorship. Revel established a college that was liberal arts. Whether he did it on principle, I don't know. The Rav on principle wanted a college that was liberal arts. No censorship. It could be Rabbi Revel had no choice. In order to get accreditation, you needed a college which was broad and open, and there was no thought control. It's not a college. It's not a Catholic college. Halacha Meiser, my cousin Rabbi Revel, and Mori Rebbe, the Rav, totally agreed on this point. With the Rav, he actually spoke about it in length, and you can see with the Rav, it was really not a bidiyavad. It was a lachatchila. A college has to be a college. Fine. Well, you're going to run a problem. You cannot control teachers. These are professors, and they're going to teach what they want. I've said many times that Mishan Mila, I'm quoting the Raman in Resh Mem Vav in Yoredeya, Misha Mile Bitno Kreso Basavayan, which means Shasim Paiskim, so you can be exposed to other ideas and you'll know how to handle it, you know how to answer it. But this is an open question, and until today, as we look out the window, we see Mechon Lev. Mechon Lev will not tolerate a course of Upi courses. We go to Queens, we go to Kew Gardens Hills, we go to Lander College. Lander College, all the classes, the Rebbeim have to approve the teachers and the courses. There, to the best of my knowledge, there's no Upi courses there. YU is not like that. More than that. As YU developed over the years, it has many more divisions. The Teachers Institute. Tov, I don't know in your time, but in my time, this was real yet. How did YU get a Teachers Institute? We're talking Merkaz HaRav split over these issues, right or wrong. They just built a multi-million dollar, billion dollar setup in the, what's it called, near Beit Lechem, that part of Jerusalem, the new part. It has a name, come on. Shmuel, okay. What's it called? Kirch,
no,
on the beyond Anona. They just built
Har Chumah.
Just built a multi-million dollar campus. That's the breakaway. Rabbi Tau, Rabbi Steinberg, they got endless money. It's some story. Wow. They built the second Merkaz HaRav there. They want nothing to do with the original Merkaz HaRav because Merkaz HaRav agreed to give teachers certificates. Morty, you're living it. You didn't. The Machlaik is, what was it, 20 years ago. My family, my brother's family, walked out of Merkaz. Half the family is now in Har Chumah. Okay. Big rebellion.
You mean Har Chumah, they don't have a teacher's
institute? No, just the yeshiva. Don't even mention the word Teachers Institute there. You're going against the original idea of Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. Merkaz HaRav, a yeshiva kedosha, in the full sense of the word, a litvashi yeshiva. Oh my gosh. Yeah, but it's not part of a yeshiva. Herzl College they could tolerate because it's outside Good, b'hatzlacha, b'hatzlacha Mori, and I'll see you b'ezrat Hashem later this week. Herzl College, they could tolerate, it's outside of the yeshiva. This, what happened in Merkaz is in the yeshiva. Teachers Institute. Yitzchak, how did it begin? After World War I, the Mizrahi in America, we're going to talk about this next week, or not, next time we meet in this class. Next week is a different class, but next time we meet in this class, we're going to talk about Zionism, what happened in America. It affects, you'll see, the whole Agudas and Rabbanim, how it was organized. It's an unbelievable story. Now, after World War I, every Jew in America is a Zionist. 99%. Mizrahi, you need teachers. Talmud Torah. Every shul has a Talmud Torah. So they organize a teachers institute. Rav Meir Berlin, Rav Meir Bar Ilan organizes it. Well, it's organized, it functions. Rav Meir Bar Ilan was not a great administrator or a great educator or a great principal. He was a man of great vision. So they pleaded with Yeshivas Rav Yitzchok Hanan, take the Teachers Institute under your wings. So Rabbi Revel agreed. But the Teachers Institute remained separate. It was different. Dorten haben sie nicht gelernt in Yiddish. Sham hen divru ivrit, hen tzirchim legadel morim sheyodim eich lelamed et hadar hachatash im hasafa hamitchadeshet. You follow? And the teachers were much broader. How many of you have studied Dat Mikra? No, Dov Dat Mikra. You study Nach Rashi, the Radak, the Metsudot. Dat Mikra is a total different experience. Some of the Melumadim that they quote there taught at the Teachers Institute. You follow? It's a different experience. Scientific. You don't just repeat a Maimon Chazal. You have to put the Maimon Chazal into space, into place, the time, the location.
There's no heresy
there. Believe me, in Dat Mikra there's no heresy, but there's a certain broadness but if you read Revel further, you'll see they taught, they showed Mr. Manashevitz, they taught Achara Am in Yeshiva College. No. Is there heresy in Achara Am? Or isn't there? Rabbi Asher Ginsberg, when he deals with Torah Shabbat Peh, he sounds exactly like a nice follower of Professor Solomon Schechter. Right or wrong? Reb David Lifshitz knew Acharam by heart. Okay. So what? Did he teach it in Shir? Bialik. All right, Yitzchak.
The first time I ever heard a bunch of Shrine.
Right, was from the Rav.
Was in the Lord's Saturday night class.
Right,
talking about the bunch of Shrines in Jewish history.
And what bunch of Shrine wanted, the Rav would cry when he spoke. Remember what he said? The Nolam Haba, a warm challah with mitabisu putra. The Rav, remember, you cried, he cried. You could see the tears in the Rav's eyes. He was a powerful vartier. Vic, you understand what the Rav is saying? You come, you know, the Jews in Flatbush, and they want to go to Lawrence. I don't want to mention it. And they're Jews that have endless money, and they want more and more. Is this the Torah way? Take a look at Bunch of Schweig, Rasvet Gevolt. Ora, we had a great Rebbe. That much I can tell you. Ora Besimcha, when you studied with the Rav. And, I knew what that like. What did you say?
Hot rolls with butter.
Hot rolls with butter. That's my fault. I say to people, I'm the happiest guy alive. That I have enough money the rest of my life. I can have hot rolls and butter. Fine, we'll put it that way. Baruch Hashem. It wasn't always that way. I just spoke with my kid brother. We had a long talk. The three brothers between us. We had a long talk. And, discussing our parents, the way we were raised. And I said to my kid brother, You were the baby. You think you suffered. We all, it was difficult at times. Parents working, money, this, that. And my brother here just wrote to us. He's the happiest. My talk made him the happiest young man alive as he goes through it, because he sees life, nothing is perfect. But you got to be thankful for what you have. Hot rolls and butter. Ah, Yitzchak, this is a problem. I'm not taking sides. But Reb Yehuda Leib Foria,
they did teach Bible criticism.
Absolutely, they taught, and what, in Bar Ilan, you don't have problems with Bible criticism? And tell me, Bernard Rebel Graduate School isn't laughed at by Hebrew U because they don't teach Bible criticism in the Bernard Rebel Graduate School? No, Beseda, but they understand. If you open the Pandora box, and in Chovevei Torah they didn't call upon a revival of Bible criticism, they were so. You have to understand these are very delicate issues. All I can tell you is Nechama Leibowitz and Yeshaya Leibowitz agreed on nothing. They were both geniuses, both knew more than all of us in this room put together times 20, but one thing they agreed upon, that Bible criticism is anti-Semitic. The whole basis of Wellhausen was to say to the world the Jews faked us out, and therefore the Jews and therefore the Jews are worthless, and everything is a copy, a shmapi, and the flood, and this and that. And both agreed that Torah Hashem to me on that level. The Chama told me this many, many times. And also, you'll see Yishai Leibowitz, very solid. But I want to end off with this part. I haven't finished, but the clock is ticking. Rabbi Yehuda Leib Foria ultimately didn't stick with Yeshivas Chochan. In other words, logically speaking, takes the train from Holyoke, Boston, the train that you would take, the New Haven Railroad it was called then, today I think it's called Amtrak or whatever, and coming to New York, all right, your eyes popped. Torah learning, the little that they had then, but they had. Logically, he should have been in Yeshivas with Chochanan. Shlomo Palachek was there, his best friend. No, he wasn't at home. He couldn't tolerate Teachers Institute, the broadness. So he winds up in Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn, Chaim Berlin was getting started. But the place where he really wound up at home was in Chafetz Chaim. He had a special kinship with Reb David Leibowitz. Reb David Leibowitz, Leibowitz in proper English, Leibowitz in Yiddish, Reb David Leibowitz was a Slabotka, a Talmud Chacham, a Musanik. He was at Teira Vidas. And that was the big split. See, in our world, we're always splitting. The atom is always splitting. We never can remain unified more than 20 years. If we remain unified 20 years, it's an achievement. And Chafetz Chaim split away from Torah Vadas. You know the details there. What happened was that Mr. Mendelevich considered himself, he is responsible for the Musa, the Hashkafer in Teira Vadas. A Rebbe has to say a Shia, Gefet, Gemara, Peirush, Rashi, Tosfat, Gefet. Nicht mehr, nothing more. Reb David Leibowitz, being a Slobodkinik, a Musanik, he occasionally gave a Musa Shmurs. They felt uncomfortable in Teira Vadas. So he went out, and he established Chafetz Chaim. And that became Reb David Leibowitz, afterwards his son Reb Chenuch. Today it continues, it's an important institution. It's around the corner from Lander College.
Queens.
It's Queens. It's mamish a block away, but it's not a feeder school. Could you believe it? They don't like the kids to go to college. They encourage them to go on to a regular yeshiva. And if you have to get a college degree, go to Touro at night. You follow? But Lander College is like Yeshiva College. It's a daytime demanding program. It's amazing. They're a block away, and they don't encourage. Yeah, go to Lander at night when it's Touro College, when you're taking Touro College classes.
Is it the same administration?
What do you mean same?
It's Lander and Touro.
It's the same overall governmental body, but it's two. You know how many different Torah institutions there are in Touro? There's Touro College, there's Lander College, there's the regular yeshiva where they have no college in the building at all. Or Chaim, I think it's called, in Kew Gardens Hills. There are many, many different...
Built all that?
Built, that's only the start of it. A medical school, a dental school, a chef school, endless schools for Gentiles, a chiropodist school, a school for paramedicals, you don't know what...
Belkin
1,000 times over. And they're in the black, not in the red. So, you follow?
So, with the medical school.
The medical school, they bought the big Catholic medical school upstate New York, and now they just opened the dental school, I believe it's in New Jersey. For every opening in the dental school, there were 17 applications. I think they could accept like 94 kids. For each opening, there were 17 kids applying. And I tried to get a kid into the medical school whose father is a prominent doctor. I couldn't get him in with all my protection. He wound up in Vermont University Medical School. But that's how great people want to get in, how good the school is. Unbelievable. Yitzchak, had Bernie Lander been the third president of Yeshiva University, the entire history would have been different. But if is the biggest word in the dictionary. So Rabbi Yehuda Leib Feuer did not feel totally at home in Yeshivas V'Shochanan. He came to Berlin, but ultimately, it was in Chafetz Chaim where he would come in, where he would give bechinot, where he would talk and learning, where he'd be one of the masmichim, and that's where he ultimately felt at home beyond his rabbinate in Holyoke.
His relationship with the
Rabbis? We're going to get to that next time. You don't have to ask. You will hear it black and white. You will get that. No, that's what I'm pleading. Yitzchak, I don't know. I can't answer him. But I only want to tell you, you should do an article for tradition on the sons of Rav with the baking of matzah, how many different explanations have come up across the world, and going back to what I believe to be the real explanation in the Sharonim, it's in
Bahalacha.
Okay, and you tie it in with Herman Wouk. Very fascinating. I don't like to talk about it in public, but you didn't realize.
Maybe somebody in a virtual
place. Yeah, maybe someone listening. My dear students, I have a gift which I made for you. This is a picture that appears in the Revel, and it appears in silver. And it's at Rabbi Revel's at Rabbi Silver's installation in Cincinnati. I believe this picture is not Cincinnati, in Springfield. Look into the Revel volume. You'll see this picture. You'll get the exact details. I believe it's 1925. I've identified some of the Rabbanim here, and here is beautiful. This will explain to you. There's Rabbi Feuer. And who's next to him? Take a look. The Mechita Eloi. You see? That explains to you. If anyone wants a copy, it's yours for your hands to enjoy.
In other words, that means that while the Mechita was alive, he did have some relationship.
Yeah, of course. There they are standing next to each other, childhood chavrutas, two Eloyim, two geniuses. And this is America. Look at these Rabbanim. And just think how little influence they had. Their balabatim, 95% of the children of their balabatim were that conservative. The next generation reform. Who is left Jewish 100 years later from their balabatim?
Even at YU, they were YU graduates, YU Yeshiva College graduates, who went to the seminary, became rabbis in Philadelphia.
Right, no, Beseder.
Whether they were Orthodox in their own personal life, I don't know, but they certainly were conservative.
And what about YU faculty? Rabbi Gerstenfeld had a son, a very prominent Reform rabbi in Washington. At Rabbi Gerstenfeld's funeral, Yeshiva refused to let him speak. The funeral was in the auditorium, and they told the son that he cannot speak. But this is America. To reiterate, all right, we accomplished today the fascinating Shia. These are names that we didn't know about, and with your research, what you uncover. But it gives you a feeling of what was happening in America at the turn of the century. The sons of the biggest Rabbanim, Rabbi Samuel Margolis and Rabbi Harry Epstein. Two prime examples.
The daughter of Margolis, the daughter married Luxtein.
Yeah, the daughter, it's the granddaughter who married Rabbi Joseph Luxtein. Yeah, it's the granddaughter. And that's how the Luxtein dynasty continues. Margolis, Luxtein, which has ended today. Now it's ended. Now it's ended. Continued for over 100 years in KJ. Okay, my dear students, next week, Be'ezrat HaNatein LeYov Koach, on Sunday, I'm letting off steam. I'm covering all contemporary topics. I am paying. I'm bringing Rakafet Aaron Chelik Gimel. Anyone who wants it, it will be given out.
I want to see Chelik Dalet.
We're working on it. We're working on it. Take my word for Yitzchak. Even today, I'll be working on it. It takes work, but it's being done. Okay. Monday, Be'ezrat Hashem, next week, it's show and tell pictures, Moscow Revisited, and I know no way better to prepare for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, what we Jews can achieve if we just apply ourselves to Torah Hashem Tamima. It's overwhelming. It's Mamish Musa right before our eyes. What a vision. And what came out of it? I still can't believe what I saw this past June. Some freebies. First of all, a book came out about Baltimore. This is Eli Schlesberg, one of the real great individuals of this world. He put out a volume, My Shtetl, Baltimore. I saw part of it in preparation. I hope to see the final product, but it looks good. This is an article now on what's going on with the shkita of kaparet, with the chickens. So could you imagine they want to outlaw the chickens, the Jews, what's happening? And here, first they came for the chickens. You follow the implication, the anti-Semitism. There may be truth to it. I don't know. Say that I understand the Rambam was terribly opposed. I also don't use a chicken. My wife's family used fish. There always used to be a fish in the bathtub. I use money, Baruch Hashem. The Jewish world. Do you know that the French police will want to watch out for Jews who are going to rob chickens for kaparis? This is in the year 2017. It's beyond words. This is about a lady who pioneered psychological first aid in Israel. A Haredi lady, I think from Beit Shemesh. She's now in Houston helping out with the tragedies there. She's a family therapist. Balin is the last name. Fascinating article. And here, of course, Lubavitcher's Save Lives on Trucks. This is about Houston, and leave it to Lubavitch to come up with an army four-wheel drive. It looks like a beautiful Jeep, Hummer, I think they call it. What's the word? Humvee. A Humvee, and there they are doing what Lubavitch can do best. Leave it to Lubavitch. You don't ask questions. How did they get it? It can go through water. I'm well aware of it. Until we meet, first of all, I want to thank everyone for coming. I want to thank all the virtual students for listening. As I told the class yesterday, and I still laugh about it, my grandson had to go to Germany to find out who his grandfather is. Could you imagine? I have a grandson, just won an international prize, number one. Then he won another prize in Germany. So he was a guest of the German government. So, of course, he had to arrange Shabbat, Kashrut, davening, and he contacted the Lubavitcher before he got there, Kearns. And then he became very friendly, nice fellow, nice shul, and Shabbos, and the chazen, and he didn't have to stay in the hotel, problems with doors, they put him out, it was beautiful. And the guy and the Lubavitcher there finds out who his grandfather is, he went crazy, I listened to his shayurim, that's your grand, etc. So at least Germany accomplished one good thing for me. My grandson had to go to Germany, find out that was all came out at the Brit. We had quite a Shabbos with the Brit, and Shabbos is not easy. The logistics of getting everyone put up. And we didn't have notice. We didn't know until Thursday, because there was a whole shaila whether the Brit is Docha Shabbos. Because my great grandson Barak was born with the Ola partly not circumcised already. So it's I did my own research.
That was but, his manner, right?
Was his manner. Yeah, no. But according to the research, you can say it's not Docha Shabbos, but that what the urologist Chari Tzedek said, you have to go to a Mo Mumcha, and he will tell you, he will decide. And the Mo Mumcha Shai Oved said, no, there's enough here that it's like a semi-regular bris. But when it was Sandek, when I held the leg, so when I was Sandek on Tuesday, the Mo didn't say anything to me. It was Weisberg. Shabbos, Shai said to me, hold very tight, don't let go until I finish the whole Brit, because this is a difficult Brit. And I could see why. In order to pull up the Erla, there wasn't the Erla, not the size on a regular, what you regularly see. So, all right, Baruch Hashem, and the kid is fine, everything worked out, and we should all have Nachat, Metzeot Seinu, and we have to be very humble. My brother and I, and we were discussing, you know, how many great-grandchildren we have, Kanai and Hara, between us. My brother's way ahead of me as a daughter. 13 children, and either, all the 13 kids, very serious, either in the army, offices, or learning full-time around the clock in Har Mar. That's what the yeshiva's called that just went to... what's it called?
Chachoma.
There's a division there with Shmuel, Chomat, Shmuel, whatever. That's where they put the yeshiva up, and it's changing the whole neighborhood, obviously, because with that type of institution, campus, it's going to attract more and more and more. So what was originally a Masorati, Dati neighborhood, is now going to become Dati Chadali neighborhood entirely. So Kanai and Hara, we have a lot to be thankful for.
So do they produce rabbis for the army?
They're very mamlachti. Oh, there, if you would say you're Sirif Pekudah, they'll throw you into jail in Harmar. They don't tolerate that. They're mamlachti, 100%. That you'll do outside, I don't know, you take courses, you go to Herzog, you go to Hebrew, I don't know, I can't answer. The head of it is Rabbi Tau. You know who Rabbi Tau is? His sister is a Goodman. That name doesn't mean anything to Moshe Goodman, Zechet Zichrono Livracha, 48, white Yeshiva College graduate, came in Aliyah very early stage. He was an officer in 73, He held negotiations with the Egyptians and English. He's an American, so he's very valuable to the Israeli army. He was in Miluim. They moved him up in rank. I think he went from major to Skan Aluf, or from a lieutenant to a major, because he was so helpful in the negotiations after the war. She is a rabbi, the head of Har Mor. Rabbi, you don't recognize the name? Tal Goodman, she was rabbi in Austria, in Vienna, and she had to leave because she insisted upon a real conversion for converts, and they were willing, it was a reform shul, who needs a real conversion with mikveh, shmikveh, and all that goes with it, hey, mazal zalim, you follow? They laugh it off, and she couldn't laugh it off. No, go and figure that one out. One rabbi is Hamar, Chadali, you understand? And the sister is a liberal rabbi who with Orthodox tendencies. Let me tell you. She was in Austria. No, she lives here, yeah. But she, her rabbinate was in Vienna. She left. Now she's back full time. She's not a young girl anymore.
She's back here.
Oh, yeah. No, no. The family's all here. The children are all here. I'll tell you even better. You all know who she is very simply. Rabbi, her late husband, I think he had a PhD, Dr. Goodman, and a Hebrew came in out of her. That's David Applebaum's uncle. David's mother was a Goodman. Do you follow? David's mother was a Goodman. David's grandfather was a Yudapayisha rabbi, American rabbi, combined two worlds. He was rabbi in Memphis, Tennessee. He was the rabbi of the big shul. And if you read Revel, he's the rabbi who cried to Rabbi Revel when I think a year ago I was learning in Israel. I think he learned in Hebron and I was davening in Israel. He was a Merkaz Harav. And now I'm in Memphis. What a difference in davening. I miss Israel.
What's her first name?
I believe it's Elsa. Something like that. You can look it up. You'll hear her. Tau Goodman or Goodman Tau. The maiden name is Tau. And T-A-U. Or T-H-A-U. Mashahu Kazir. Yeah. And David, the whole world. It was David. Nava, that's one family. Goodman, Savitsky, it's... All right, we got to clear out of the room because I imagine the Pidyon HaBen is over. It should be over.
When
is
it going to be over?
Until the end of health and happiness, Das Vedanya.